Hello, Billy Patterson here. Nearly 30 years ago on my Castaway programs, I talked with local people about their lives. Stay tuned and listen again to the following fascinating story. Hello, good evening, and welcome to another Castaway, 7 o'clock this Sunday night. Now, I expect you know about Castaway by now, but our well-known person this week that we're going to deposit on the island is a gentleman. He is the chairman of McGee & Company, the renowned, world-renowned, I may say, Tweed Company in Donegal Town. And his name is Howard Lynn Temple, Bachelor of Arts. Howard, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much, Billy.
Now, you were born where, Howard?
I was born in Donegal in the year 1913, so I'll be 79 next June.
In June?
In June of this year, I'll be 79.
How do you feel about it?
Beginning to feel that I'm getting a little bit old, but fortunately I still manage to keep very, very active. I seem to get busier than ever before, and that's the way it should be.
Well, I think as we go along your life, we'll see that you've always been an active person. Now, that was June 1913 in Donegal?
In Donegal.
In
that's
the town.
Correct. In the town of Donegal. That's
well,
right.
Your dad and mum, would you like to tell us a bit about
Well, my father was a Donegal man himself. He came from Kilgordon, County Donegal. And in the year 1887, he came over to McGee's of Donegal, to a man called John McGee, who had a shop in Donegal and also did a tweed business, buying the tweed in the various Tweed March, like Ardra, Glencolum, Kilcar, etc. And my father came in to his cousin's shop in the year 1887.
To work
there. It's rather interesting, actually, how he came, because the previous Christmas he had been out shooting. Perhaps that's where I get my love of sport. And he and his brother shot a few woodcock. And money being scarce, they decided they'd walk as far as Stranorna, and that maybe they could sell them for a bit of pocket money. Mm-hmm. And actually, they took them into Keyes Hotel in Stranorna, mm-hmm. and they sold the woodcock, and they were very hungry then, and they decided that they should go down to a cousin of theirs in Ballybuffet, who had a shop, McGee's. So they went down there, then had tea, and ate it up very well, and then they walked home again to Kilgordon. And some months later, John McGee in Donegal was looking for an apprentice, and he happened to mention to his brother, and he said, well, there was a young man called Robert Temple. He says he came down for tea there just before Christmas last year, and he says, I was greatly struck with him. So they said, I'll tell you what we'll do. We'll drive over, and they drove through Barnesmore Gap in a pony and trap, and went on up to Kilgordon, and the upshot was that my father decided he would join them, and he entered the firm in 1887.
What age was your dad whenever he joined?
He was about 17 or thereabouts.
So he wasn't long left school at that stage?
No, he wasn't long left school. He had gone to school in Belfast. He didn't like it. They made him wear a bowler hat there, and he wasn't at all happy. And he decided that, I think he ran away from school, to be quite honest. Yeah, yeah. So that was the story.
That's how he came to
work for McGee's.
John McGee, if I can interrupt you now, he founded the company.
He founded the company around 1866.
1866. And what he did was he went out and he bought the product of the weavers from the cottages
correct.
All around.
That's correct.
And what did he do with them?
They were brought into Donegal, they were scoured and washed, and they were sold to a very great extent into Great Britain, into England.
And used for clothing
used
industry?
For clothing, used for clothing.
Right. What about your mother, Howard Ellen?
My mother came from Northern Ireland, Swatra, County Derry.
She was Ellen?
She was Ellen Sarah Sarah Hill. And they got married. I forget what year they got married. I must confess I should have thought of that. But they got married, and very happily married, and she took a great interest in the business.
Were you fond of your mother?
I was very, very fond of my mother and very fond of my father. Mm. And the funny thing about my father was, I really think all his life, he had a love of farming because he'd been brought up on a farm. And I really think if he made £5 on a bullock, he was happier than if he made quite a lot of money on selling cloth.
Is that right? So he was a farmer at heart?
He was definitely a farmer at heart.
What about other members of the family, brothers and sisters?
Well, he had a number of brothers. There were three of us, my brother Wilbur, and two sisters, Helen and Kay. My brother Wilbur had just one idea. He did not want to go into the business. He didn't know what he wanted to do, but he certainly didn't want to go into the business. For some unknown reason from the word go, as I was the elder brother, I had one sister older, I was destined to go into the business from the word go. And when I was sort of 10 and 11 and all the rest of it, I used to have the job of working in the shop on a Saturday afternoon, for which I received the large sum of 1 shilling pay, 12 old pennies.
This is now as a boy of 10, and there was a shop at that stage.
And the tweed business.
So what did the shop sell?
It sold. It was a general draper shop in Donegal, McGee.
Right.
But the tweed business was also developed, and my father used to go all round the marts collecting the tweed and bringing them back to Donegal. And then they were scoured and washed and so. But then he found that this was not really the best thing because, unfortunately, the people were just going for quantity rather than quality. And he realized that if there was any future in this business, that it had to be based on quality. And that became the precept. He took over the business in the year 1901.
Mm.
And he had the McGees as sleeping partners until 1910.
He bought John McGee out.
Right. That's right. Mm. And that went on. And then the tweed business during the First World War was, there was a scarcity of cloth and there was a great demand for tweed. But then finally in 1922, there was a terrible slump. And in May 1922, there was a mart in Ardragh, and there wasn't a single yard of tweed sold. And that was a very, very serious situation because there'd been a tremendous development in the tweed trade, and there were a lot of people dependent on it for their living.
Well, if I could interject at this stage, because I want to come back to that point about the slump, but if I could ask you what this first, on this island, you're going to have 6 records with you. What would your first choice of a record be, Howard?
Well, obviously, since I'm Donegal born and bred and lived there all my life, it must be the hills of Donegal.
Oh, night and day I'm dreaming of the hills of Donegal, the heather on the hillside and the sunshine over all. And 'tis westward I'd be going across the ocean blue to wake again those happy hours that long ago I knew. That long ago I knew.
Now, that was a little bit of the Hills of Donegal. We never have time to play them all, isn't that a pity?
Thank you very much. A lovely version of it.
That was by the Foyle Singers and the conduct, onto the baton, the conductor Michael Mason. Right, the hills of Donegal. Now, why was there a slump in 1922? What caused that
slump? Well, there was just a general slump. There was a lack of demand. There had been a lot of tweed made. There hadn't been a lot of attention to quality. And it was just a general slump. It was a worldwide slump, regrettably, much the same as the kind of recession that we have today.
Yeah.
Just lack of demand, lack of confidence. And it took years for that to be to recover. In fact, my father realized that he must have his own weavers working exclusively for him and making to the quality standards and the design standards which were required for an international market. And that's how the business was built up.
Well, while we're on the business, designing the tweed, who designed the tweed in those days?
Well, the number of designs were relatively limited, as you can understand, at that particular time. And traditionally, Donegal tweed, unlike Harris tweed, tends to be speckled. And I have always maintained, it may sound fanciful, but I still believe it's right, that the design style came from the granite which is in the hills of Donegal. If you take a look at a piece of granite, it's exactly the same as a piece of Donegal, of the original Donegal tweed, with white and blue and red and green and different colours coming out in the granite.
And this was created in the wool by...
And that was created in the wool, correct. Mm.
And do you think this is where they got their inspiration?
I am certain it's where they got the inspiration, because Harris had nothing like that.
Mm. Well, it was certainly a winner, wasn't it?
It was.
Well, let's go back a little bit. Your first school was the National School, wasn't it?
The first school was the National School in Donegal.
And Hunter's School?
No, it was. I think it was Mr. Ray was the was the head of it. A very strict disciplinarian, if I can use the word.
Okay.
And but a very, very, very good teacher.
What do you remember about those days in your primary school? Anything? And did your father insist that you went?
Well, I had to go to the school quite definitely. I used to take French lessons with the Reverend Kelly, who was the Church of Ireland rector. That was before I was going on to a secondary school. And it was rather amusing during those times, for some unknown reason, there used to be a lot of fights, particularly on a fair day. And there were two clergymen in Donegal at that particular time. One was the Reverend Kelly, and the other was Father Kelly. And the fights used to bring out, and I can still remember quite distinctly, Father Kelly belabouring his side with a blackthorn stick and the Reverend Kelly belabouring his side with another blackthorn stick and separating them.
Is that right?
In one of the kind of faction fights where people tended to get a bit drunk.
I think there were a lot more fights in those
days.
There were a lot of fights in those days. Tempers were easy.
For no particular reason, but just there they were. It was a bit of sport.
something to do on the fair day.
Something to do on the fair
slow,
day.
Yeah.
That's right.
So from the National School, did your teacher have any particular influence on you? I'm always interested in my castaways. Who were the biggest influences in their lives? What made them the people they are? That's what I'm interested in.
Well, I was very influenced by my father and mother. I was very, very, very fond of both of them. I was more influenced, I think, by when I went to Methody. I went to Methody at 11 or 12, and there I was very influenced because I was mad keen on sport of all kinds.
Why did you go to Methody? Was that not a sort of a nearer secondary school?
No, I just honestly don't know why my father decided he would go there, and my brother in due course didn't go to Bethany. He went to Portora. I think the idea was we had to have something to fight about during the holidays.
Wilbur went to Portora,
I went to Bethany.
He became a doctor, didn't he?
He became a doctor,
yeah.
That's right.
Now, in Methody, you were quite a good student, were you, Howard?
I was a reasonably good student. I worked quite hard, but I was more interested in rugby and running and diving and everything of that nature. I really was keen on... I was played for the under-13, I played for the under-14, I played for the under-15 medallions, and finally I played in the school's cup. At Ravenhill.
That's the final, the School's
the
Cup.
The School's Cup final.
First 15.
Who
did you win it?
We were beaten.
who did you play against?
In Speeders, 14-5.
Is that right?
I was playing wing three-quarter, and I was marking another fellow who had the reputation of being one of the fastest men in Ulster. Running,
right?
I mean. And... I think, really, I would have killed myself rather than let that fellow get past me.
Really?
But there you are.
Matter of pride.
Yes. But being on the school cup team was a very useful thing because, you see, there was such a thing as known as the starvation table, which I'm glad to say wasn't the starvation table. It was the very reverse. You used to get scrambled eggs for tea. That was absolutely marvellous.
Why did you get scrambled eggs for tea?
Because, you were being trained for the school's cup.
I see. You did better than the other guys.
You did better than the other guys.
I see. Let me ask you now at this stage about your second record that you might choose to take with you. To this island?
Well, I've always been very, very fond of a Welsh choir, a male voice choir. And I think you have got a good Welsh male voice choir for me.
We have. It's a lovely piece of music called Mavanwy.
Yes.
And it's the Vroncosuste male voice choir.
Yeah.
You'll like this. Mavanwy by the Vroncosuste male voice choir. It's actually spelled Francilsacite or something like that.
Yes, it's a very difficult word to pronounce, lot of Welsh words.
I rang Wales to find out how.
Did you really?
I did.
Yeah.
Vroncosuste. Now, Howard Temple, you're at Methody College now, but you passed your exams. You did well at
I did.
Sporting.
I passed junior and senior certificate.
And honours and all that.
And then I went down to Trinity.
And you went to Trinity. But you were also an athlete in those days. You did a bit of 100 yards.
I did a lot of running. I won the school seniors 220 and all that kind of thing. I was played wing three-quarter at rugby, and I was reasonably fast.
You must have been.
And I was very keen. I represented the school in the Ulster Athletic Championships and all this kind of thing.
Very good. And you were second in the Ulster Diving Championships.
I was.
Pipped on the post. Right, you then went to Trinity.
I then went to Trinity, and I lived in Trinity for the first year. But then the problem was that my father wasn't very well, and I could see quite clearly that if I spent the next 3 years in Trinity, that it was going to be very, very difficult for him with the business. So I decided that instead of, after the first year, which I enjoyed greatly, I decided that you could do such a thing as keeping your term by exams.
Mm.
And that meant that I took two exams per annum instead of the usual one. And I would go down for a few weeks in June, and again in November or December, and would do or again in January, and I would stay there, and I would do two exams per annum, and I took my degree that way. And meantime, I had gone into the business and started working there. So I had to work at home at night to get my degree and also work in the business. But it just, that was the way it was.
Hard work, Howard. What were you reading in Trinity?
Well, I did all sorts of things. I did psychology, I did economics, geology, and the usual other courses up to, little go up to the second year.
But then it was back and to work. Now, you say your dad wasn't that well. Wilbur was off doing his doctor thing.
That's right.
And the business was then in your hands. When did he hand it over to you, absolutely?
Well, around about 1938-39 or thereabouts, he wasn't in great health, and he still continued to come in and continued to come in all his life and liked meeting customers and talking to them and all. But gradually I took over control of the business, although he still advised me and helped me in every way he possibly could, and I was always very glad of his advice, which was excellent and glad to have. And he still took a tremendous interest in what was happening in the business.
How much of your life then was in the field, Howard, or were you just sort of keeping the books?
No. I was the very reverse. I had to go through every section of the business at the beginning. I learned to deal with the post, to parcel, to cut suit lengths. I could tell you every number, I think, of cloth that we ran in the range, and I could still visualize a particular pattern in my own mind that was such a pattern that we were running in those olden days. And I used to do all sorts of jobs, like take the post to the post office in a van, or sometimes during the war years, certainly it wasn't in a van because there was no petrol, it would have been in a little spring cart.
Yeah.
And that's the kind of thing that I did. But I had to work my way right through the business to every sector of it.
And how was it possible to keep the quality high? You had to insist on certain standards, didn't you?
Well, we have always had this idea that quality and design are preeminent and must be observed, and there must be no concessions to lack of quality. And that is the same thing. In due course, we obviously went into the manufacture of men's clothing. That is a further development of the company. And there again, to this day, that is the most important thing that we have, design and quality. And that you must have top quality if you're going to succeed.
Oh, well, you have succeeded, so you've had top quality all along. Processes that your people, who were spread around all over the country making these lengths of cloth for you, did you supervise them in it?
Well, we had obviously a manager who supervised and various supervisors who dealt with the actual detail of it. But I was an overall charge, just as my son now is an overall charge of the entire business.
So how much was done when it got to you? The sheep had been shorn, wool had been
spun,
and there was you were getting in lengths of tweed.
Yeah, we were getting in a web of cloth, and then you had to scour it, which we do to this day, and finish it, shrink it thoroughly. It has to be examined at the very beginning and checked for quality, and you would count the number of picks to an inch, you see, because the card given out to the weaver said 20 picks to an inch, and when it came in, it had to be checked in that way, 20 picks to an inch, to see that it was regular.
Right, I'll tell you what I would like to do is for you to tell us what your third piece of music would be that you would take.
Well, I've always been very, very keen, slightly highbrow perhaps, I don't know, on Tchaikovsky's Piano Concerto.
You'd like to hear a little excerpt, would you?
I'd like to hear a little bit of that.
All right. We have a little excerpt of Tchaikovsky's first piano concerto in B-flat minor, and it's played for you, Howard, by Shuro Tcherkassky.
Thank you. Thank you.
was a little excerpt of the first piano concerto by Tchaikovsky. You were so successful with your quality control and your tweeds. Were you exporting in those earlier days?
Oh, yes, quite definitely. The export trade was the very important trade.
To where in particular? Was it all UK?
Well, America, we opened up the American market to quite an extent. And that still is for our cloth side. I must make it clear, you see, that we have at the present time in McGee's got these different sectors. The one is the tweed manufacture, but the very, very important one now is the clothing manufacture, where we make men's high-grade suits, jackets and slacks, and make them in Donegal, and also have a factory in Northern Ireland and outside Ballymena, where we also make men's high-grade clothing.
When did you go into manufacturing the actual clothing?
Well, in actually, what really happened was that when the war ended, I could see quite clearly that there was going to be a demand, I felt, for quality clothing. And I also could see that the old tailoring concept was going to be difficult because people had not served their time to tailoring during the war. And I therefore felt that if we could go into clothing manufacture and initially make clothing from cloths which were characteristically Irish, that there could be a good market for it. And we therefore decided that we would develop clothing made from our own tweeds and also from the Irish thornproof, which we were making. And in this way that we would try to open up a market. And we initially, we had a warehouse in Belfast, which my father had taken over around 1923 or 24, and I decided that I would go into clothing manufacture there, and because there was no future for a woolen merchant's business, and we developed that particular trade, and it gave us a vertical uplift. In other words, that we could make our own tweeds in Donegal, and also we had a chance of selling them in clothing, which was a great, very great help, and has been to this day. And now, of course, the clothing is the major side of the business, a very, very important side, with two factories and a total employment of approximately 550 people between the two, between Donegal and Ballymena. That also, of course, includes the tweed sector in Donegal.
Great success story, Howard. A very, well, very good idea of yours.
There's a very deep recession at the moment, and it's not at all easy.
No, I know that, yeah.
It was rather interesting, though, that in the 60s, the American government introduced a quota system. And we were very, very concerned as to what this was going to happen to our tweed weavers. So we didn't know what to do. And my brother-in-law, who was in charge of the tweed division at that particular time, and Bob Harris.
All right.
And we got together, and I don't know which of us made the suggestion, I think he did, to the effect that we should see what could be done to enlist the help of the Irish-American societies.
Well, if you've just joined us, my guest on Castaway this week is Mr. Howard Temple, who is the chairman of McGee's Tweeds from Donegal Town. It's McGee and Company, isn't it, Howard?
McGee and Company
McGee
Limited.
Yes. You were telling us that the USA introduced a rather excessive tariff on woolen imports.
That's correct.
So excessive that it was going to seriously damage the business.
Yes.
The export business.
The export business. So we didn't know what to do about it.
And yourself and your brother-in-law, Mr. Harris, got together.
That's right. We got together, and we got the list of all the Irish societies in America. And we formed a Donegal Tweed Association because we couldn't advertise just as a company. And we got in touch with several of the other manufacturers in County Donegal, and we asked them, we told our own weavers, actually, we're forming an association, and we printed notepaper, Donegal Handwoven Tweed Association, and we circularized the secretary of every Irish society in America, and asked them, told them about what was happening, that weavers were being put out of their jobs, and that what possible damage could tweeds made by hand in Donegal due to the great American woolen and worsted industry.
Yes.
And you know, the Irish-Americans, they may or may not buy Irish goods, but they are great when they get a political angle. And, of course, we asked them to write to their deputies and congressmen and senators, and there's no doubt whatsoever that they did that in a very big way. Mm. And it finally ended up with a decision in Washington to have a Senate hearing. And Bob Harris, my brother-in-law, was asked to go out to America, and he got great help from the Irish government, and they had a very, very good barrister or attorney to help him. And he appeared before the Senate Investigating Committee, and he told the Senate Investigating Committee that before he had left County Donegal, that there were prayers in all the churches, Catholic and Protestant, for the success of his mission, to help the employment. And before he was finished, the Senate was practically crying for him. And at any rate, he was successful, so successful in it that they actually changed the law. And to this day, hand-woven tweed under 31 inches in width is admitted to America at a lower rate of duty than any other cloth.
That saved the industry.
That went a long way to save the industry.
I bet it did.
It's quite an interesting story.
That was a great success.
Well, it was. There's no doubt about that. Mm. We had a local girl who's just retired very recently, Teresa McBrearty, who was the secretary of the Donegal Hand Woven Tweed, and she was getting letters from all over the place, "Dear Teresa."
I had the pleasure of meeting her at a little function that was run for you some time ago.
That's right.
Yeah. Well, we'll wish Teresa well. She's just retired.
She's just retired quite recently, last year.
Now, all these clothes that you decided that you started making in-house,
yes,
as opposed to sending out the tweeds to bespoke tailors who,
yeah,
would buy lengths of tweed.
That's
from,
right.
That's the way it was for a while, but then, how many people now do you employ actually making suits, ready to wear?
Well, we employ 220 in Northern Ireland and about 255 in Donegal, in that particular section.
That's tremendous.
That is making, yeah, we are making approximately between the two factories over 3,000 sleeved garments a week.
That's tremendous, Howard.
Which is a lot of dough. And we're selling those suits to the top retailers in Ireland, in Dublin, all over Ireland, and the leading independent stores in Great Britain. If you go into any man's shop in Great Britain, or any town in Great Britain, you will find, in England or Scotland, you'll find a McGee stockist there who is selling McGee clothing. And in this, we're having to compete with the Germans, the French, the Italians. We've got to meet them on equal terms so that quality and design are of supreme importance.
But you have sold also to the premier fashion houses throughout the world.
Oh, absolutely, yes. There's no doubt about that. And we're exporting clothing to Japan. We're also exporting cloth to Japan. We're exporting clothing to America, to Germany, to Belgium, to France, to Great Britain, as well as our own factory in Northern Ireland, so that we are, and we have to develop the clothing side. And there we're having to compete with the international firms, and we've got to design to absolute international standards of the highest degree.
If I was Yves Saint Laurent, let's say, and I ring you up and I say, I want a certain tweed. I want it with this colour, that colour, and the other colour. Can you do that?
Oh, yes. We would work very, very closely on the cloth side with leading firms with a view to designing what they require.
What's going to be in that
what
season.
What they feel it's in. And
yeah,
our designers would go to all, and we would exhibit at the leading trade fairs, and we also show our clothing at, say, Cologne and places like that, the Cologne Men's Trade Fair, on a regular basis. And in that way, we are trying to develop more and more. We would have agents for both cloth and clothing in the leading countries throughout Europe and the world.
A great success story, Howard. Now I'm going to ask you what your fourth choice of record would be.
Well, I always liked The Lord's My Shepherd. It's one of my favourite tunes, to the tune Crimond, and perhaps we could have that if that's possible.
Yes, we can. Miss Moira Anderson.
Good.
Slightly different version there, Howard.
Yes, but a lovely one.
It's nice,
lovely,
isn't it?
Lovely,
yeah, she has a nice voice, that girl.
Beautiful.
Where and when did you meet Maureen Woods?
Well, around 1945, my sister, Helen, brought Maureen to visit us in Donegal.
She's a friend of Helen's.
She was a friend of Helen's. She was very young at the time. I think she was around 16 or 17 or thereabouts.
And you were what?
And I was, I was a lot older. I'm 13 years older than she is.
Are you?
And I
thought she was a nice little girl.
I thought she was a very nice little girl. And she then went to the Adelaide Hospital to be a nurse, and we kept in touch over the years.
Where was she from, and by the way?
She was born in Tonakilty, County Cork.
Was she?
Yes. And her father actually was a clergyman. And they lived in Tonakilty and then in the Midlands of Ireland, and mainly in Longford. They were in Longford when I knew them. It must be, it's rather funny. I married a daughter of the church, and Lynn, my son, has also married a daughter of the church.
Great leaning towards the church there.
It must be that. I don't know what it is.
So how did Maureen come back into your life?
So then we kept in touch, and at any rate I realised quite definitely that she was the person for me, and she was kind enough to say that she would marry me, and we got married in 1949. And may I say, I have never, never, never regretted it, because she has been a tremendous help to me in every possible way. She could, in every way, in connection with the business, socially, and everything else. We have a very happy marriage, I'm glad to say. And we have got 3 children and 9 grandchildren. So we're getting the best of both worlds now with 9 grandchildren. All the fun of seeing them and all the rest of it without the worry of really looking after them.
Well, you married Maureen, and you had 2 daughters and
2 daughters,
a son.
And 1 son.
Tell us about them. Now, Lynn is the son.
Lynn is the son, and he is now chief executive of McGee's.
Right.
And he has to bear the brunt of the entire. At my age, I obviously have got to stand back and as much as possible and let the younger people in every area within the business run it.
Did you find that hard to do, Howard? A lot of people find it hard to let go of the reins.
Not at all easy, because you've been used to doing it, and I'm sure still they think that, I wish to goodness that old fellow wouldn't poke into this or that.
Interfering old sons.
Yes, I'm sure they feel that sometimes.
But you like to keep a fatherly interest in it.
Well, I try not to interfere with the detail to the best of my ability, and I try to just advise where I can, or where I feel that my advice might be helpful. And I must say that it is always received very, very well indeed.
Good. And the 2 girls?
The 2 girls, well, I was very lucky, because you see, Claire, my daughter, married a chap called Dermot Moore, who's a surgeon in Dublin, and it just so happens that his father was Norman Moore. He became superintendent of St. Patrick's Hospital in Dublin and professor of psychiatry in Trinity. And he was my best friend. He was my best man at our wedding. So that Dermot, his son, married my daughter, and we really were more looking on Dermot as an extra son, and yeah. have still.
Mm.
And then my other daughter married Robert Brabazon, a farmer in West Meath.
That's Caroline.
That's Caroline.
Mm.
And she's very happy down there. And again, I enjoy going there because they keep horses and Robert's very interested in hunting and shooting and this kind of thing, as well as being a very hard working farmer.
Well, that's very good. How did you get interested? You were always interested in hunting yourself, hard, weren't
you? I was always interested in hunting and I was interested in horses. I think I inherited my father's love of horses. He used to keep always a good trotting horse in days gone by, and was very fond of a good horse, and I inherited his love of it. And then I got on to hunting, and I became very, very keen at. I was keen on all field sports, fishing, shooting, and hunting, but hunting was my first love.
Was it?
And finally, I became master of the Strabane and Donegal Hounds in 1969 to carry it on, and then for 16 years as joint master with Dan Smith.
Right. Is it the thrill of the chase, or just the fact that you're out in the open air belting along in leaping ditches?
It's the fact of being out in the open air.
With friends.
With friends. The element of danger in it.
And to you.
For you.
And what
personally.
About the poor fox?
The poor fox doesn't really worry in the slightest. I really am afraid that I don't think that people realize. I have seen a fox been hunted by hounds running through a farm yard and lifting a chicken with it. And if you can tell me that fox really was worried about the situation, I don't think he was.
Yeah.
It's his nature to hunt and be hunted. It may sound callous, but it's not really. And quite honestly, we were very, very, very careful. If a fox was put to ground, he was humanely killed, quite definitely.
Very good. And fishing is another of your loves. You've always been a great outdoor man.
I've always been keen on fishing and shooting and all field sports. And I get a lot of enjoyment out of it. And you meet an awful lot of very, very nice people. I still go on to the River Finn and the River Oanea and Loch Melvin. And I meet people there and you get talking to them and you learn an awful lot. And it's the very fact of being out in the open air, the very fact of seeing the birds, perhaps you get a fish, perhaps you don't. It doesn't really matter.
Mm.
It's the fresh air, the scenery and everything like that.
That's my excuse every time I come home empty-handed.
Yeah, same here. I come home too often empty-handed, unfortunately.
You were instrumental in setting up the golf course at Merva, weren't you? You were a great golfer.
Well, I was never a great golfer. I must
you were
confess.
a good golfer.
I was a keen golfer at one stage.
There is a subtle
but
difference.
I really was very keen many years, in a number of years ago, they wanted to start a golf club in Donegal. And the local priest was very keen on it.
Was that Father Tommy
Father
Doherty?
Father Tommy Doherty.
Yes. Yeah.
A great friend of mine.
Mm-hmm.
And the local bank manager, Clements, was one of them, and Hill. And we got together anyway, and there was a lot of talk about whether or not we could start a club. So, finally, my father had died. This was in 1958. And we got together as a family, and we decided that it would be a nice gesture in memory of him if we could buy the land to make into a golf course for Donegal. And that was done. And we started the golf course in Donegal, bought the land there, and started the club. At that stage, it was a 9-hole club. And the rule that was put into the Constitution was, and it is to this day in the Constitution, that it was to be a club where neither class nor creed had any part. And that is the rule of the Donegal Golf Course to this day. And then subsequently, the committee had an opportunity of going into Merva, which to make an 18-hole course. And they came to me and said, what about this? Because we had inserted a provision into the original purchase that in the event of the golf course not succeeding, that the land was to be retained as a park for the benefit of Donegal Town. So they asked, was there any objection if they sold the land to create the new club? And I could see very clearly that there was a great advantage in starting the seaside course with a sandy base in Merva. And I said, not at all, we'd be delighted, provided that it was called the Donegal Golf Club and that the same rules were in the Constitution. And it is to this day, and it is now a championship course, one of the best courses in Ireland.
You also got involved in Donegal Development Association, looking after the town of Donegal, isn't that right?
Well, early on I was in the Donegal Development Association, and that was trying to develop the town of Donegal. It's still going quite strong, and we've also now got a very active Chamber of Commerce as well as the Donegal Development Association. One of my pet things is trying to get rid of litter. I'm an anti-litter fiend in every possible way, and I'm always talking about this and asking for help in any way we possibly can to get rid of litter, because I feel it's so unsightly and so unnecessary. And I always try to encourage school children and everyone else and teachers to teach children, which I think is the answer for our litter problem in Ireland, to be tidy and not to be throwing papers and everything else about the place.
It's a big bugbear of mine too. I hate it. We have litter laws, but I'm not sure that they're enforced adequately.
No, maybe I'm sorry to say that. I feel they should be much more strongly enforced. I think it would be a good idea, really, that when people do go out of their way to drop litter, just ad lib, I feel that it is very sad that something is not done about it.
Yeah,
because it is an eyesore for visitors. We're trying to run a tourist industry, and there's nothing worse than coming into a town on a Sunday morning and seeing litter all over the place.
Right. Let's move to record number 6 now, Howard.
Well, this particular year, of course, I thought about this when you invited me to come here, and I felt that really, because of the... Is it the 250th year?
I think it is.
Of Handel's Messiah, that I couldn't omit having the Hallelujah Chorus, or a little bit of it.
Howard, you've had a good life. You've worked hard, you've enjoyed it, you've been lucky in your wife and your family. Have you any particular regrets in your life?
It's very difficult to say what be. I'm sure I have regrets that I didn't take advantage of some of the opportunities that I have, and that kind of thing. But there you are. It's very easy to have regrets with hindsight and be wise afterward. Perhaps the odd one would be the big salmon that just got off the hook at the last minute.
Oh, they're not too serious, and they're the only regrets you have. Now, on this island, if you were cast adrift on an island, how useful would you be in making a shelter or a boat or whatever?
I would be very bad at it.
Would you?
I would be pretty hopeless, to be quite honest.
You're not a man with the hands.
I'm not a man with the hands at all, I'm sorry to say.
And with your own company? Would you get very lonely very quickly, or do you enjoy being on your own?
Oh, I'm a great reader and very, very fond of reading. I would certainly be lonely, very lonely, I would think, without a doubt.
Well, what two books would you take with you to
read?
Well,
I would...
Apart from the Bible.
Obviously, you'd want the Bible.
You're getting that, yeah.
But you get that anyway. Well, I would like to take a good long history of Ireland. I've always wanted to sit down and really study a good history of Ireland, and I never seem to get time to do it in the way that I should. And the second thing would be...
Well, let me recommend one to you. Robert Key's History of Ireland.
That's right.
Excellent.
That's
as impartial as you're going to get.
It is.
And your second?
My second, for a good laugh, The Irish RM.
Oh,
Somerville and Ross.
That's brilliant, yeah. That's a brilliant story. Well, two very, very good choices indeed. And if you had one little luxury to take with you?
Well, of course, the luxury that I would want to take with me would be my wife, but I suppose that's a necessity.
It is. Yeah, that would be a necessity.
You'll
have to choose something.
So I've got to choose something else. Mm. Well, I think probably that the most useful thing I could bring with me would be possibly a fishing rod.
Ah, well, all right. We'll give you the fishing rod, all
good.
Right.
Good. Thank you very much.
Howard Temple, congratulations on the company, McGee & Company, continued success, and thank you very much indeed for being my castaway this week.
Thank you very much indeed, and I would just like to say that the success of my company is not due to me, it's due to all the wonderful people who work in the company and work with me, and work for my son. Thank you.
Thank you.